Welcome. This lecture is the first of a series of lectures being given by British foreign secretaries. The other lectures include Lord Carrington, who will talk next week, and his topic is the continuing problems. That will be followed by Lord Howe on the 21st of October, Lord Hurd on the 11th of November, and Sir Malcolm Rifkind on the 18th of November. I would also like to draw your attention to the LSE International Relations Department lecture series. The topic is the transatlantic relationship after September the 11th, and those lectures are on the 30th of October, the 24th of November, and the 4th of December. Tonight, to reflect on British diplomacy, we'll welcome Lord David Owen, and I'm delighted to have the honour to chair his talk. Lord Owen is a former Navy Minister, Health Minister, and Foreign Secretary under Labour governments. He was leader of the Social Democratic Party from 1983 to 1990, EU peace negotiator in the former Yugoslavia from 1992 to 1995, and he is currently chairman of UCOS International UK. He's also chairman of New Europe, which together with Business for Sterling forms the No campaign against Britain's entry into the single currency. Tonight, however, he's going to talk about a subject close to the heart of anybody who studies foreign policy analysis, and that is the ever-growing dominance of number 10 in British diplomacy since the 5th of April, 1982. Lord Owen.
Thanks. Well, on Monday, the 5th of April, you may have wondered why I chose that title in the title of the speech, 1982, with an extremely personal decision. The then Foreign Secretary, Peter Carrington, resigned following the Argentine invasion of the Falkland Islands. And as he wrote in his memoirs, the anger of the British people and Parliament at the Argentine invasion of the Falklands was a righteous anger, and it was my duty and fate to do something to assuage it. Now, this principled resignation seems to be the last principled resignation we've seen to some extent, but there we are, had far-reaching consequences, for it marked a quantum step in the weakening of the power and influence of the Secretary of State for Foreign and Commonwealth Affairs. It also started an institutional and political build-up of the role of number 10 in the conduct of UK foreign and security policy at the expense of the Foreign Office and the Ministry of Defence. I don't deny it's been happening before, but this quantum leap, I think, is quite clearly dated around this point. It also relates to the nature of Peter Carrington's position in the Conservative Party, his relationship with Margaret Thatcher. When he left, it was much easier for changes. There also followed after that two periods in which collective cabinet government was devalued. Notice I'm giving an academic lecture, so this is my language is suitably modified, moderated, devalued from 1985 to 1990 under Margaret Thatcher and 1997 to 2003 under the present Prime Minister. Cabinet meetings still took place, as happened, for example, in recent months over Iraq, in the made clear by Robin Cook. But the form was observed doesn't mean that the practice had not substantially changed. And decisions were taken by the Prime Minister, sometimes with a few selected cabinet ministers being involved, but the real decisions were effectively more and more taken by a single person. Cabinet government is, of course, bound to differ under different prime ministers. Inevitably, it is affected by their personality, the extent of their dominance in their own party, and many other factors. Jim Callaghan believed, and acted on the basis of that belief, that the Prime Minister, the Chancellor of the Exchequer, the Foreign and Commonwealth Secretary, and the Home Secretary should never go to Cabinet differing on an issue without at least trying first to resolve any disagreement amongst themselves. and to take an example of that, in 1977, I wanted a Commonwealth peacekeeping force rather than a UN force to implement the Anglo-American plan for Rhodesia. Jim Callaghan, aware that Dennis Healey, along with Tony Benn, was going to argue for a United Nations force, and I'd given them the option, the two options, warned me. That's a pretty strange situation. You wouldn't get that, I suspect. And gave me the opportunity to change my recommendation in the cabinet paper, because it goes to the cabinet secretary, first of all, and the cabinet prime minister authorizes whether a cabinet paper goes forward. And saying that he could not push a Commonwealth force through if, as he suspected, Dennis Healey had significant support in arguing for the UN. Now, young, brash, and firmly believing a Commonwealth option was better than a UN option, I chose to go ahead, and I was promptly defeated. And though I still thought, and I think the subsequent events in Lancaster House showed that the Commonwealth option was a better one, nevertheless, I had no cause for complaint and didn't complain. It was not an issue which the Prime Minister should have felt obliged to force through Cabinet, nor is Cabinet just about consulting Cabinet colleagues or even an inner Cabinet. Cabinet government is about involving the government departments at every appropriate level through their ministers who can draw on past experience. And in this case, Dennis Healey's 6 years as Defence Secretary was a legitimate basis on which to quill upon and to argue an issue out in Cabinet. Now, the strength of Cabinet government lies in its ability to draw not just on that departmental expertise and legal advice, but in ministers having consulted within the department, coming into the Cabinet meeting briefed, so that it becomes a decision-making meeting of the Cabinet, with members having spoken to a number of experts within the department and sometimes experts from outside, drawing on a knowledge base that enriches and informs the decision-making process. Now, some would say, oh, this is idealistic and that sort of thing. Of course, 22 members don't all come. But in the core and key decision-making, 5 or 6 people usually contribute to the discussion in a serious way. And in my experience, and I think whatever criticism can be made about Callaghan, he was widely acknowledged to be an expert in handling the Cabinet and in bringing Cabinet government to its fruition and bringing together many different factions and views. Then, if you have that form of Cabinet government, it has an added advantage. It makes it much more likely that the Cabinet's decision will carry right through the political party and into Parliament. So it may take a little bit longer, but you have usually more coherence. And also, if things go wrong, it's buttressed by collective responsibility. Cabinet government has, therefore, many forms, but in essence, the Prime Minister is primus inter pares, not a president. Now, both Margaret Thatcher and Tony Blair have devised techniques to downplay Cabinet decision-making. But we need to remember one big difference. Margaret Thatcher shared the ideology of her party activists, so she was intent on their views coming through, whereas Tony Blair does not identify with the ideology of his party activists, and he doesn't want them to come through. So they approach the problem in a similar way, and they've used largely similar techniques, but for different reasons. Allied, of course, to their own personal wish to be central decision makers. Cabinet government, as developed during the 20th century in the UK, you can have its criticisms, you can see it sometimes working well, sometimes not so well, that nevertheless, in my judgment, remains the best way yet found of handling a fusion of the executive and the legislature. And though it's called a cabinet in the United States, that cabinet does not govern collectively, but serves the president, who is the executive, an arrangement which makes sense where there is a separation of power between the strong presidential executive and a congressional legislature with real strength. Now, it is difficult, but not impossible, for the cabinet in the UK to disown a specific policy of a prime minister. Churchill in the 1950s attempted a summit diplomacy with the Soviet Union, which the Americans didn't approve of, and the cabinet effectively disowned. Eden was forced to halt the British troops advancing along the Suez Canal by the intervention of the cabinet, in particular the then Chancellor of the Exchequer, calling attention to what was happening to the reserves. In June 1969, the proposed trade union legislation, called In Place of Strife, was abandoned by the cabinet, though Harold Wilson nevertheless remained prime minister. If you read it, many people say Wilson gave way. Quite the contrary, Wilson held out right to the last moment with Barbara Castle and was then virtually given an ultimatum. You either accept this legislation is blocked or you have to leave. He then talked to the trade unions, but he stayed. Now, and remained prime minister. Had Margaret Thatcher's rejection of German reunification been maintained, it might have been challenged even by her lot of cabinet ministers, as it was potentially, for a few weeks, extraordinarily damaging. Now, to some extent, Mitterrand held the same view, but he kept quiet about it, but she made it very, very obvious, and it was an absurd policy, but it didn't last long enough for it to cause the crisis that it might have done. Now, Margaret Thatcher initially did practice cabinet government, but even so, by 1982, decisions began to be taken under her in Number 10 on the basis of minutes circulated amongst senior cabinet ministers without meeting, even when there were differences in a view expressed. And we had a glimpse of this in the Franks report over the deployment of HMS Endurance. Now, over the Falklands, with her own personal position on the line, it was understandable that she concentrated decision-making in Number 10. She believed, rightly or wrongly, that if the Falklands had remained in Argentinian hands, she wouldn't have remained Prime Minister. And I think that was a fairly accurate assessment of what was likely to have happened. But she also began a process of devaluing the cabinet, aided by the fact that her new Foreign Secretary, Francis Pym, never had her full confidence, helped this process because of centralizing decisions in Number 10, and also the reality that the Secretary of State for Defense, John Knott, was already a political casualty of the Falklands, having lost command of the House of Commons in the debate on Saturday, the 3rd of April. She actually recruited into Number 10 a recently retired former permanent undersecretary of the diplomatic service, Sir Michael Palliser, to help handle the diplomatic traffic that was going to come under this more centralized mechanism. And the Chief of Defense Staff, Admiral of the Fleet, Sir Terence Loon, in effect worked direct to the Prime Minister. A small war cabinet was formed, and I think few would deny that in conducting a complex, fast-moving military operation, the whole cabinet cannot be involved. Margaret Thatcher was, however, determined to take control of foreign policy, and she acquired her first foreign policy advisor in Number 10 at the start of 1983, when Anthony Parsons, previously the UK's permanent representative of the UN and an extremely fine diplomat, came in to work there 3 days a week. He didn't much like it and pushed off to Exeter University and formed a Middle East division after only a few months. And what is not often noticed is that at the same time, a defense advisor who was also appointed, but interestingly, Michael Heseltine refused to cooperate. He was then Minister of Defense, and he forbade his officials to take the advisor's telephone calls, and so froze the poor individual out. So when, in September, the foreign policy advisor, a new one was appointed after Tony Parsons, and that was Sir Percy Craddock, this defense advisor was subsumed into the foreign policy advisor's role. And Percy Craddock, who'd been our ambassador in China, when he took over, continued actually as deputy undersecretary in the Foreign Office, responsible for the Hong Kong negotiations, which I think he did extremely well, also with Geoffrey Howe, one of the few areas in which Margaret Thatcher delegated responsibility to Geoffrey Howe. But from 1985 until he retired in 1992, Percy Craddock also combined the job of advisor with being chairman of the Joint Intelligence Committee, with wide responsibilities for British intelligence. Now, we all know about the Joint Intelligence Committee. The Foreign Office, I may say, reacted to this new post of foreign policy advisor by devising a set of self-denying ordinances, which the advisor was invited to sign, which Percy Craddock, with a smile, signed. The problems arose not with the Percy Craddock appointment, but when Charles Powell, urged on by Margaret Thatcher, developed the post of Private Secretary Foreign Affairs in a way that was far removed from the role of his predecessors, normal, unobtrusive diplomacy and cooperative working with the Foreign Office. During the Westland affair in late 1985, early 1986, Mrs. Thatcher's whole style of government began to be seriously questioned. Michael Heseltine, after resigning, charged her with having destroyed cabinet government. Even though Westland Helicopter Company was being considered by the cabinet's economic committee and not by the Overseas and Defence Committee, the private secretary handling it was Charles Powell and not his nominal superior from the Treasury, Nigel Wicks. And according to Geoffrey Howe, who had good reason to resent Charles Powell acting unprecedentedly as a gatekeeper for the Foreign Secretary's access to the Prime Minister, Powell was the dominant civil servant in Number 10. And I quote him, that is Geoffrey Howe, increasingly exclusive role was becoming a matter of serious concern throughout Whitehall as well as in Cabinet. Now, an earlier sign that the machinery of government was not working effectively on international affairs came earlier when the heads of government met in Stuttgart on the 19th of June 1983 in the European Community, and they agreed the solemn declaration on the European Union as part of relaunching the community. Now, I don't know what you're told about the declaration, but the declaration dealt with everything. Economic strategy, the European Monetary System, EMS, Economic and Monetary Union, EMU, economic cohesion, external relations, and the developing countries. Completion of the internal market was surprisingly not given great prominence in the declaration, being included as part of the title Development of Community Policies. Yet, by any standard, this declaration will be, in the history of the European Community, one of its more significant documents. But it was never seen as such by the UK, whether in government, parliament, or the press. The declaration was described in the half-yearly report from the government to parliament on developments in the European Community as the Genscher Colombo Declaration, saying it was, and I quote, not a legal instrument and involves no treaty amendments or increases in the powers of the institutions. How wrong that proved to be. That declaration paved the way for much more than just the single market, but also for far more extensive use of qualified majority voting and for the false claim that a single market needs a single currency. Now, the declaration, by bringing together EMS and EMU, disguised the fact that they were different conceptual designs. The EMS is a technical way, albeit a flawed way, as we saw in the UK in 1992, of trying to achieve monetary stability, particularly flawed for the UK economy. Whereas EMU is first and foremost a political decision to abandon UK control of interest rates and of the Westminster Parliament setting inflation and unemployment targets, and you lock your currencies together and merge them into one currency. Now, not enough attention was given throughout the 1980s in the UK, in any of the political parties, in Parliament or in the press, to the nature of the political agenda that lay behind EMU, although you can quote some prominent warning speeches. Eventually, this was grappled with in the Maastricht negotiations by Prime Minister John Major. And after John Major came into and as Prime Minister, he did return some power to the Foreign Secretary, Douglas Hurd, and also the post of Foreign Policy Advisor lapsed. Now, one powerful political figure who has never blurred the distinction between EMS and EMU is Nigel Lawson. Even as Financial Secretary in 1981, while pretty open-minded about joining the ERM, he was adamantly against EMU. And if I could say for my own position and Callaghan, we paved the way and joined the exchange rate mechanism. And we joined the EMS, not the exchange rate mechanism, but the EMS was the structure within the exchange rate mechanism. We opted out effectively. Now, that distinction was clear in Callaghan's mind, clear in Nigel Lawson's mind. In Lawson's autobiography, explains how both he and Geoffrey Howe tried in 1985 to join the exchange rate mechanism. I was in favor of it at that time. I think it would have been a good decision. The Prime Minister, however, simply vetoed the ERM entry by saying, if you join the EMS, you will have to do so without me. That's in a quote from Lawson. An implicit veto is part of a Prime Minister's legitimate authority, I would argue. Lawson and Howe could have taken it to full cabinet, but they were not willing to risk all by asking the cabinet to endorse ERM entry against such adamant opposition, and they were wise. But in effect by then, cabinet government had ceased to exist, as the Westland affair confirmed. And one of the problems was that after ignoring Nigel Lawson's views on the ERM, Mrs. Thatcher was in no mood a few weeks later to treat seriously his specific objections to making any new treaty commitments in what was to become the single act covering European monetary union prior to the meeting of the European Council in Luxembourg in December 1985. Now, Lawson sent her two memos, one dated the 14th of November, saying that, and I quote, the inclusion of EMU as a treaty objective would be a political commitment going well beyond previous references to EMU, which have been non-binding European Council resolutions or solemn declarations. Quite correct. And again on the 28th of November, he minuted her, there should be no reference in the treaty to EMU, since this, which implies progress towards a common currency and a common central bank, would be no more credible to outside opinion than the commitments entered into in 1971 and 1972, and as in any case, are politically unacceptable to the UK. Now, Margaret Thatcher in her memoirs recalls some of Nigel Lawson's warnings, but claims that the formula she accepted, which added to the phrase economic and monetary union, provided an important gloss by describing it as cooperation in economic and monetary policy, and that this signalled the limits the Act placed on it. She thought she had surrendered no important British interest, but this was emphatically not the case. And it's very bizarre, and a reflection on the considerable limitations of unrestrained prime ministerial decision-making, that even with Charles Powell advising her, who was also always against EMU, she personally, albeit by default, conceded the objective of EMU in the community. It cannot be respectably argued that this was the price for achieving her principal objective, the single market, or as it was then termed, the internal market. For this was already agreed within the community by then, and all ready to be put in place. Nevertheless, a new, major, and unjustifiable concession was extracted from a Prime Minister who was utterly opposed to the very principle of monetary union. It was also done against the advice of her Chancellor of the Exchequer and without substantive discussion in Cabinet. It's an extraordinary saga. Yet, in 1985, that EMU wording gave the newly reappointed President of the European Commission, Jacques Delors, the pre-legislative authority to bring about a single European currency. Margaret Thatcher's surprising concession was then compounded at the European Council in Hanover in June 1988, by her agreeing to establish a committee of the community's central bank governors in their personal capacities to be chaired by Jacques Delors. And when challenged in the House of Commons about this new committee, Margaret Thatcher merely reiterated sort of bland statement, with regard to the European Central Bank, we have taken part in a single European Act, which went through the House and which said that we would make progressive steps to the realization of monetary union, and we have set up a group to consider that. Monetary union would be the first step, but progress towards it would not necessarily involve a single currency or a European Central Bank. As a considerable civil servant drafting to cover up the commitment she's made then. Now, if even an inner cabinet had operated in 1985, it would have been much easier for the Treasury objections coming from the Chancellor of Exchequer, Nigel Lawson, to be heard, and at least that group knowing that they were entering into far deeper commitments than were superficially appeared and were being glossed over. Over the Maastricht negotiations in 1991, by contrast, other departmental ministers' views were taken into account, particularly, if you could, those of Michael Howard, who was neither Chancellor nor Foreign Secretary at the time. Under Harold Wilson, in the run-up to the 1975 referendum, the Cabinet was fully involved, and he and the Foreign Secretary, then Jim Callaghan, and the Chancellor, Dennis Healey, masterminded the so-called renegotiations. Under Jim Callaghan in 1977, the Cabinet established the all-important enlargement priority as the best counter to federalism, on a paper the Prime Minister asked me to write for a political cabinet with no officials present. Progressive enlargement became thereafter a key UK priority under all governments for checking integration. Our first priority in 1977 was to ensure that Portugal and Spain came into the community in addition to Greece. And I read back over that cabinet paper which I prepared only a few weeks ago. Even there, I'd forgotten that Spain hadn't quite yet applied, and the Commission and France were aiming at just enlarging to Greece and not taking in Portugal and Spain. But fortunately, we did manage to enlarge from 9 to 12, and then from 12 to 15, and now in the spring of next year, from 15 to 25. Under John Major in 1991, the cabinet was fully involved in both the structure of the Maastricht Treaty and in demanding the two opt-outs for the UK on the euro and the social chapter. And he faced a situation where it was not possible at that juncture to say no to the euro for the rest of the community because of the commitments I've already entered into. The most that we could have done then was the opt-out, similar, if you like, to the opt-out from the exchange rate mechanism that Callaghan and I had negotiated in 78. Now, the role of the Prime Minister, I just want to be quite clear about this, does not exist in isolation. I understand that it has to adapt to change patterns both at home and abroad. From 1992 to 95, as the EU negotiated in the Balkans, I saw the structure of the UK government as it had evolved since I left it in 79. I was virtually an honorary member of the European Council of Foreign Ministers too, and I saw how that had evolved from political cooperation getting deeper involvement in foreign policy. I saw many matters referred to number 10 at that time, which in my day I would have settled within the department. But I well understood why this was so, for there had been a clear trend for prime ministers to be sucked into decisions over certainly the common foreign and security policy as it developed post-Maastricht, and through the now quarterly meetings of the European Council. Also, it's a fact, more heads of government seem to travel to London, and more issues cross over into differing departments, not just foreign policy or defence, but take in many other departments as EU policy gets deeper into UK life. But when all that is admitted, it does not mean that cabinet government has to be abandoned. In fact, I believe it becomes more important. For when a prime minister states a policy in a meeting of the European Council, it is virtually set in concrete. Extraordinarily difficult to change it. Also, I understand that NATO's involvement in the war in Kosovo, the events of 11th of September 2001 in New York and in Washington and Philadelphia, as well as the global threat of Al-Qaeda, the removal of the Taliban government in Afghanistan, were all events which would have brought any incumbent in number 10 more and more into a dialogue with other heads of government and involvement in decision-making on international affairs. But I would argue that these trends in many ways should have made Tony Blair readier to draw on a wider range of experience from departments and from ministers. Unfortunately, he chose to follow Margaret Thatcher's route and centralize decision-making on a permanent basis in number 10. In Tony Blair's first term, his method of working was fairly close to that of Margaret Thatcher. Cabinet government was set to one side, power was sucked into number 10, but by and large, he was working with the same institutional structures, including the key departments. In 2001, after the general election, he made the most sweeping changes ever made in the conduct of UK foreign and security policy in the machinery of government. He brought the European unit from the Cabinet Office, where under earlier governments it had worked coordinating departmental responsibilities into number 10, into a new European secretariat. So he took it from the Cabinet Office into number 10. And he created a new overseas and defense secretariat, again in number 10, drawing this time from some of the Cabinet Office functions previously supervised by the Cabinet Secretary. The secretariats were headed up by two high-flying permanent undersecretaries, Stephen Wall and David Manning, coming from being the UK's permanent representative to the EU in the case of Stephen Wall, and from being the permanent representative to NATO in the case of David Manning. Now, both those diplomats are ideally qualified for each of those jobs. Both were at the peak, or still are at the peak of their careers, and both are capable of working all hours of the day and night and backed by serious staff. Despite both secretariats doing all they can to involve the Foreign Office and the Defence Ministry, it's not their fault, but the structure's fault, that within which they work, they cannot do anything else but create a personal decision-making point around the Prime Minister. However hard the secretariat strive to involve that wider expertise that exists in the three large departments of state, Foreign Office, Defence, not so large, but getting larger, overseas development, the structure within which they work concentrates advice, power, and executive command in the person of Tony Blair. And this is no accident, for he designed it to do so. The first challenge facing this new structure was the integrationist wish to reopen the Nice Treaty and have yet another IGC. Sadly, we see the results in the draft constitutional treaty. Tony Blair has made many of the same mistakes that Margaret Thatcher made over the Single Act. The loose way in which the convention was established at Laeken. Didn't have to go for a convention. Accepting the use of the convention procedure yet again, when we had already seen the problems that come from the convention procedure through the diffuse Charter of Fundamental Rights, which was already known to have many problems for the UK and still has many problems for the UK. It was then conceded, in my judgment, far too soon that there would have to be a constitution, and we misjudged the momentum the convention was bound to build up. Now, those were very personal decisions. I don't know what was discussed in cabinet. The community method, I do know this, can only be checked and on occasions defeated with intellectual rigor and by involving the whole range of skills available to the UK government through the departmental structure. That combination of skills was effectively deployed over the Maastricht Treaty negotiations with the creation of the pillared treaty structure and its two intergovernmental pillars. The pillared structure has just now been washed away in the draft treaty by a mixture of inattention to detail in the convention and much political wishful thinking by Tony Blair and a strange obsession with creating a new post of President of the European Council. Now, without firm moorings, any EU negotiating position is swept away by winds and tides of the integrationists' long-term goals. It is a characteristic of personalized decision-making that it deals best with broad concepts, but the community method progresses through detailed legislative drafting, which push integration by nuance and sleight of hand. Experience, I think, from both these periods of Thatcher and of Blair, indicate that the integrationists' objectives have been achieved in the community and still are being achieved in the European Union when the UK's decision-making is concentrated with the Prime Minister in number 10, whether it's Margaret Thatcher or Tony Blair. She didn't want it to happen, and yet it happened. He arguably does want it to happen, and it's happened. Now, I don't know how much he wants it to happen. We hear different sides of the story. What is a red line in one IGC becomes acceptable in the next IGC. Now, it is prime ministers, no use blaming officials and civil servants, it's prime ministers who acquiesce in committees or conventions being established by the European Council. When their reports are then received, which are usually integrationists, the next step is that advisers argue that there is no danger of imminent action since it's only an agreement in principle and does not call for specific action. It is prime ministers who then agree in principle in the Council, sometimes forgetting that the principle is then included as part of community practice in all future statements or declarations of objectives. Then when incorporation of the principle in words comes into a first draft, albeit tentative, as the wording for a suggested treaty, therefore having legislative form, it's already developed a semi-official status. It then gains support amongst member states, until at an IGC, to prevent it becoming binding legislation, a prime minister has to be ready to hold out and veto the wording. A prime minister, if he's ready to risk a veto, faces the charge of being unnecessarily provocative from their fellow heads of government, and they wonder how many vetoes they can use. And the argument comes up from officials that the traffic will only bear two vetoes, or three vetoes. Certainly, you can't have more than this, since you have to prioritize, by which time you've got five or six serious issues at issue, and you have to concede three or four, so they say, in the negotiating process. Now, Margaret Thatcher talked a lot about using the veto, but did not, on the big issue of EMU, use the veto. In the case of Tony Blair, because of his criticisms of John Major using the veto in the period after the Maastricht Treaty, probably once or twice inadvisably, you one sense that he's particularly reluctant to use the veto for fear that the Tories will say, ah, now you're using the veto. A problem that uniquely faces Tony Blair, however, and this is different from Margaret Thatcher, is that he needs to dominate foreign and security policy because he very clearly does not dominate economic and fiscal policy. So I think almost all the criticism that you read in the press of President Blair falls at the first fence, for he's allowed Gordon Brown a decision-making power which goes far beyond that conceded by any other post-war Prime Minister to their Chancellors of the Exchequer, whether Attlee to Cripps, Churchill to Butler, Wilson to Jenkins, Callaghan to Healy, Thatcher to Lawson, or Major to Clark. As a consequence, we have today two large areas of policy outside the normal cabinet machinery. One domestic, controlled by the Chancellor from the Treasury, one overseas policy, controlled by the Prime Minister from Number 10. Now, whereas in my day, the Foreign Office and the Foreign Secretary was responsible for overseas development. It was a separate dependent under a senior minister, in my case, under Judith Hart. But it was nevertheless coordinated by the Foreign Office, and I think very sensibly so. It, of course, was made a separate ministry again in 1997 by Tony Blair, as Wilson had done from 64 to 70. And this has also served to diminish the role of the Foreign Secretary. For the Prime Minister has not just done this mechanistic change, but he's assumed an oversight function of development policies, and to do this, he has built up a specific expertise within Number 10. For a short while, in 2001 and 2002, it looked as if this new centralization of foreign and defense policy in Number 10 was succeeding. Came in immediately after the election, so there was very little criticism, very little public criticism. The opposition was in no position to make Clint. The press more or less went by. Blair and Bush were in constant communication, and if Jeff Hoon and Jack Straw featured even less than Donald Rumsfeld and Colin Powell over Iraq, few cared, as long as it worked. Blair's honeymoon period from 1997 to now, like Thatcher's from 1982 to 88, looked as if it would last. But it has not lasted for Tony Blair. Hubris was followed by nemesis for Thatcher. So it could for Blair, unless there are changes of organization as well as attitude in Number 10. And I say this, somebody who is broadly unfavorable for most of the things that this government's been doing. The biggest foreign and security policy failure in the UK to date has been Suez, when Eden, as Prime Minister, as his wife said, brought the canal into his sitting room in Number 10 with disastrous consequences. And that is what he virtually did. The Foreign Office was completely, and defense policy were totally excluded from everything. And concentration of all power of decision making was in Number 10. We haven't yet seen anything quite as bad as that. But it was a total disaster. The Foreign Office felt they were completely out of the loop, and as indeed they were. The defense chiefs of staff felt they were out of the loop, and indeed they were. We've now experienced two tests of Tony Blair's Number 10 secretariats and his style of personal diplomacy: the pending constitutional treaty negotiations, which I've dealt with in some detail, and the handling of the Iraq war. And on both issues, the Prime Minister has to date, and this is most important, not been able to command the broad consent of the British public. You may say, well, no public Prime Minister always contains the broad consent. But foreign policy and defense policy is different. Consent is normally given for international policies, and he had the support of the Conservative opposition over Iraq. Indeed, its leaders are now being attacked for giving too much support, though, of course, he did not have it on Europe. The absence of consent does not of itself make the policies wrong, but it is troubling for any Democrat, and it should make for questioning the way in which the government is operating. On the constitutional treaty, I do not believe that we have yet begun to see the potential dangers. We've drifted into a situation where, with the rejection of a referendum, the majority of the British people will be wanting to be rescued by a rejection of the treaty by other member states in their referenda. If that happens, what a humiliating situation for a country that normally prides itself on its democracy. First Keith Vass and then Peter Hain showed their inexperience as ministers for Europe. Vass on the Declaration of Fundamental Rights, as saying it was no more significance than the Beano, and Hain on the Constitutional Treaty as being merely a tidying up exercise. Both were facile observations, and there were many such similar comments. To have as our senior government figure on the convention, Peter Hain, when Secretary of State for Wales, and for a short time as leader of the House, was a lost opportunity. What happened when France and Germany saw the convention gaining in influence? They moved promptly to increase their representation to that of their two powerful foreign ministers, who knew and got much of what they wanted. And a lot of the things that went wrong with that convention, in my view, were in the last few weeks when changes were made in the Presidium, strongly influenced by Joska Fischer and by Vielpind. Now, why was the Foreign Secretary Jack Straw not involved? Who, whatever your criticism on, is good on detail and is a lawyer. I know that well, for he worked for Peter Shaw as a political advisor when I was Foreign Secretary. And Peter Shaw's mastery of European matters I used to encounter regularly when I chaired the European Cabinet Committee. The answer is that having Hayne there ensured prime ministerial control. The Prime Minister's personal priority for a President of the European Council looks likely now to be achieved. That's in place of the rotating presidency, which everybody guys because it was rotating every 6 months. It was a perfectly sensible mechanism for a community of nine, just about manageable on 12, beginning to be strained on 15, and bound to have to be changed on 25. But there were ways of grouping the presidencies, either in geographical locations into six or eight groupings, and having a rotating presidency. But we pushed immediately from Britain for this president of the European Council. How much collective discussion took place about that? How many people warned that if you put the priority on this, many of your other claims will go by default, because you will be putting all your negotiating pressure on this one subject? At that time, many people thought the Prime Minister saw himself as the next President of the European Council. Well, we would probably see it achieved, but we've predictably expended far too much negotiating capital on this issue. What is not so well known is that unless the present draft is amended, the President of the Council's post, which remember is for 2.5 years, extendable for 5, could be double-hatted. The community is very fond of this technique. You have two posts and you combine them together. And you could combine the President of the Council's post with the President of the Commission or with the High Representative for Foreign Affairs just by a qualified majority of the European Council. And in one single step, you've made a President for Europe, because put those two powers together and you really have taken a gigantic step forward, or backwards, as some of us would think. Now, also I believe Tony Blair has put much too much reliance in the prior negotiating of the UK's position on the Convention's Presidium to having a retired former Permanent Under-Secretary for the Diplomatic Service, Sir John Kerr, as the head of the Convention Secretariat, no doubt helped by the Foreign Office in arguing for this. Now, John Kerr's loyalty and brilliant mind had to primarily serve the Convention's President, Giscard d'Estaing. He was no longer a member of the Diplomatic Service. He was no longer prime obligation was to the UK. His prime obligation was to make a success of the Convention and to serve and to go to the majority and certainly to serve the President. We shouldn't therefore be surprised that we've been faced with a treaty which is very cleverly constructed. Now, after one term as French President, Giscard d'Estaing had become a member of the European Parliament and, in my view, has become a deeply integrationist in many of his attitudes, as indeed have quite a lot of centrist French politicians become integrationist. It's very easy to keep saying France will never concede foreign policy, France will never concede giving up control of its defense policy. You can point to quite a lot of figures in the Socialist Party, Fabius, Michel Rocard is an old friend of mine, total absolute integrationists, their former defense policy, integrationists. And in the Giscardians and in the centrist ring, many of them are too. Now, just before I go any further, for many of you may well be integrationists and may well want a full and extended European community. And you are entitled to that claim, and it's a perfectly honorable position. I disagree with it, but I don't in any way criticize your right to it and your right to take it. What I do criticize, and will fight, though I'm a passé figure now, as much as I can, is the idea to do it without people knowing you're doing it, without the full-hearted consent of the British people. There are serious problems to doing these things without it. We tried in 72, Ted Heath, to push through without the full-hearted consent. It was only when we had the referendum that we began to rally opinion. Even then, we had a lot of problems with this issue, and we're still having problems with public attitudes to Europe. Now, we've therefore got, in my judgment, a lot of negotiating ground to make up on this treaty. The intergovernmental pillared structure, as I say, was abandoned much too early. We're facing the necessity of significant amendments in this IGC. And yet, we're now hearing from France, Germany, Italy, and I think from the British government, from what I read of what they were saying in Berlin, and most recently in Rome, that, oh, let's treat it just as a minor exercise, a few amendments here. Let's rally around the convention. It's much easier. Have a short thing, complete it all by December. Well, Who's ever seen a draft treaty which has not yet been discussed by the British Parliament in detail? They've never seen the whole package, and many of these issues we only actually saw at the end of July. Who's ever seen a constitution like that drafted through and pushed through by the end of December? Now, we do unfortunately probably need it by the time we enlarge, but it's going to take every single month between now and enlargement to get this treaty in good shape. Now, the constitutional treaty involves, of course, both these secretariats that have been set up in Number 10. And now that David Manning has gone to Washington to be the ambassador there, the new head of the Overseas and Defence Secretariat has very little defence expertise. He's an EU specialist, was our head of our team in Brussels. And so we're going to have, in the arguments over the treaty now, some fundamental questions about defence policy. The Chirac-Blair-St. Malo agreement over defence in December 1998, further compounded by the disarray in the EU in the run-up to Nice, caused considerable anxiety in NATO. Fortunately, I thought the issue had been resolved by the EU-NATO-Berlin Plus negotiations. And those of you who follow it saw that it did meet all the serious objections, not just of the Americans, but of our own military commanders in SACA and elsewhere. It hardly was the ink dry before, in the draft constitutional treaty published in July of this year, France, Germany, Belgium, and Luxembourg were being offered the very thing that they were much derided for being asking for a few months before, a separate European common defence policy. It come served up in the nature of a new wording, structured cooperation on defence, is in the draft treaty. But also in the draft treaty, it explicitly says that this structured cooperation is the same as enhanced cooperation. And it goes on to reel out all the powers of enhanced cooperation, which you may remember was conceded in Nice. Yet in the Treaty of Nice, enhanced cooperation was specifically excluded from covering defence and military matters. And on the 11th of December 2000, Tony Blair came in a statement to the House of Commons after the Nice negotiations. He actually called this exclusion another key British objective. So just a few years goes by, and another key British objective is abandoned, and we take a structural coordination in defence policy, which we know is going to be extremely divisive within NATO and within the European nations within NATO, let alone for complicating already fraught relations across the Atlantic. The Prime Minister went to Berlin on 20th of September this year, conceded structured defence cooperation while Parliament was not sitting, without making any formal public announcement, leaked out through Der Spiegel and a few other German newspapers, a little bit in The Economist, very little, nothing actually in The Times. Now, this is not even parliamentary government, let alone cabinet government. Now, if you make a commitment in Parliament, it's been a tradition in Britain that you don't change that commitment without coming back to Parliament and making clear what you've done and why you've done it and changed it. Now, we're being asked to accept by the Convention the new title of a Union Minister for Foreign Affairs, who is also to be a Vice President of the Commission. So much for CFSP being purely intergovernmental. This first ever use of the name Minister is a clear attempt to pretend that the EU is a government. People say, of course it's not a government. Then why do you need a minister? Ministers have ministries. Now they say, well, we're going to create an External Affairs Secretariat. Now, the British government, we're told, is unhappy with the title. Yet you've only got to lay in which they express their unhappiness to realise that they're sounding pretty irresolute. Also, the Convention has presented, very late in the day, an open-ended clause, 24, capable of introducing qualified majority voting whenever the European Council agrees. It has to be by unanimous. But if that means that you avoid any need for the full treaty amendment procedures and ratification by all member states, because they don't like the idea that the Danes may vote against it, or the Irish may vote against it, or indeed their own countries might vote against it. Now, these are very dangerous steps to go down. A constitution ought to be entrenched. Look at all the constitutions you've been studying. How many of those constitutions can be just made changed by a temporary political arrangement, a temporary agreement? It requires procedures. You have to ratify them. The American constitution can't be changed. I think I'm right in saying it has to be more than a majority of the states. Now, that's the normal way. This draft constitutional treaty cannot be read as an endorsement of the Prime Minister's method of dealing with EU matters. It's a constant worry to us that this method is not working. Quite the contrary. It's a sign that the centralisation of EU matters in Downing Street, in my judgment, is not working and will get worse at present times. Now, come to the Iraq war. I supported, and I still support, Tony Blair. I'm going to answer questions, so you can have a go at me on that at any time you like. But I don't need to await Lord Hutton's verdict to judge that the Joint Intelligence Committee machinery, which I've known well and respected and used ever since I came into the Ministry of Defence first as a junior minister in 68, was corrupted in the run-up to that war in a way which will leave damage for decades to come. It was always boring. It was always very tentative in making conclusions. It was the result of a very cautious mechanism separated out, and deliberately so, from political inputs. I couldn't tell, as Foreign Secretary, the diplomat who often chaired the JIC, what conclusion I wanted out of it, what political policy I was pursuing. He went there, or she, in both cases men and women, have chaired the JIC, and they objectively tried to give the best advice to the British government. Now, it's impossible to believe that Sir Anthony Duff, Sir Percy Craddock, the person I mentioned, or Dame Pauline Neville-Jones, to name but three heads of the JIC with whom I've worked, would ever have conducted themselves as John Scarlett did with Jonathan Powell and Alistair Campbell over amending the statement on Iraqi weapons of mass destruction. It's also the first time it's actually been chaired by somebody from MI6. And as for the other so-called dodgy dossier, on which Alistair Campbell has already apologised, it just left our Joint Intelligence Services a laughing stock across the Atlantic, where it's troubling, let alone anywhere else. Now, amongst the reasons for these failures is the number 10 matey atmosphere, the corner-cutting, somewhat shambolic structure of centralised defence and security decision-making, which were revealed in the Hutton hearings. I personally don't need to make any claims that people were deliberately deceiving or this was all a conspiracy or anything like that. I just look at the structure. I look at the way, at the shambles that there was. And I say to myself, don't go on with that structure if you want credible handling of foreign affairs, and particularly complex questions like we saw and are seeing in the aftermath of Iraq war. I do not pretend that I feel personally misled by Tony Blair over what he has said over weapons of mass destruction, though I have, I admit, been surprised that no actual weapons have yet been found. But nevertheless, millions of British citizens do feel deceived. Ever since Saddam Hussein attacked the Kurds and the Marsh Arabs after the ceasefire in 1991, I felt it was essential to topple Saddam Hussein from power for the good of the whole Middle East region. I argued, in Guardian and elsewhere, the best justification for military action in terms of the UN Charter lay in Saddam Hussein's flagrant disregard of UN ceasefire resolutions from 1991 onwards. And it's in the interests of everyone, many of you here, who hate war, to uphold the concept of negotiated ceasefires and not reach a state of international cynicism where wars can only be ended by unconditional surrender because you can never trust ceasefires. And with it will come a much greater loss of life. Over Iraq, it's not my purpose to carp, but to pose a few relevant questions. The Cabinet, we're told, discussed Iraq fairly frequently, but the Foreign Office, the Ministry of Defence, and the Ministry of Overseas Development were not deeply enough involved, and in part this seems to be why the UK was not able to plan for the war's aftermath more effectively. Now, the tendency is to just say, well, it's all the Americans' fault. We can't blame just the US administration. Basra, which is the area that we were allocated, has, it appears, been somewhat better handled than Baghdad, but there have still been major deficiencies in our own UK post-war area of responsibility. In the first Gulf War of 1990 to 91, which forced the Iraqis out of Kuwait, our cooperation with the US military was based on component commanders and a joint force commander who had considerable influence. We knew we were going to fight for months ahead. We planned accordingly in good time. In the 2003 Iraq war, we only had contingent commanders and a national contingent commander. And I pose the question, did this mean we were so fully integrated that we lost all independence? Why was an airman, our senior officer and US commander's HQ, when it was obvious no Iraqi planes would fly, and we knew from Afghanistan that that same US commander's strong point was not nation building, and that therefore it would have struck anyone as logic. For the post-war period in Iraq, we would need from the UK a person with ground experience in Bosnia and Kosovo, and that we should focus our attention on nation building and draw on that experience. We need over the Iraq war, but we will not get an inquiry like Sir Oliver Franks conducted after the Falklands War, the press constantly give the impression, and the Tories do, that this was graciously conceded by Margaret Thatcher in the aftermath of defeat. Don't believe a word of it. It was conceded by her under pressure during the earliest parts of the war, when people like myself, who were fully supportive of it, but who believed that some serious errors had been made in the early part of the Falklands War, demanded an inquiry, and she conceded the principle under pressure, and then went on to set up Oliver Franks once the war was over. Now, what must be questioned is how much of our mistakes relate back to the way the Iraqi war was run by the Defense and Overseas Secretariat out of number 10. As I say, that won't be answered by any official inquiry. For example, while the military campaign was very successful, because the US in particular had maintained political momentum, having gone to Congress for authorization in the autumn of 2002, how much better it would have been if we'd gone to Parliament in the autumn of 2002. Now, we went to Parliament eventually, and I think that was a new innovation and a good one, but it was already much too late. Planning for the aftermath had been too Pentagon dominated in the US, and we knew that from the controversy between the Department of State, and had been hampered in the UK by the politicians keeping their fingers crossed. We heard that graphically described by Robin Cook from the Prime Minister, that there would not be a war. I think, in fairness, the Prime Minister, he may have told Robin Cook he was keeping his fingers crossed, but he knew perfectly well that he was going to war. But not everybody else knew in the Whitehall. Many other people were hoping somehow, against all hope, that it wouldn't happen. And if you think it's not going to happen, you don't plan for it. Neither the US nor the UK appear to have anticipated that Saddam Hussein might stage a guerrilla war after defeat in a conventional battle. And they were, it seems, too confident the former Iraqi military units would come across the coalition. Many just disappeared with their weapons, and then the Iraqi army was unwisely and precipitately totally disbanded. Now, Ambassador John Sawyers, as an emergency appointment, was suddenly put in from being ambassador in Cairo. He did a fine job on the ground after the war, as I would expect, using his political skills and expertise. But why was there no one earmarked for this role months before? Now, these are legitimate questions. Why did we not put in a very senior political figure or diplomatic figure, albeit temporarily, into Washington, once Christopher Mayer, our ambassador there, felt he had to go, and David Manning could not be spared, because the ambassador was already announced to take him? So we had a situation, and it's not to be, we have a very able deputy there, but given the differences we knew that were taking place between Donald Rumsfeld and Colin Powell, we were not represented at a very senior level during this all-important post-war reconstruction period. Also, why, for all the Prime Minister's bilateral, trilateral, and multilateral meetings with Jacques Chirac and Gerhard Schroeder, not just the quarterly meetings, but endless bilaterals and others at other times, did we fail to anticipate French opportunism and German readiness to go along with it? Were there any warnings from the Foreign Office about the movement of French opinion? The strategy of going for a second vote in the Security Council was urged on President Bush by Tony Blair. The Americans had absolutely no intention of risking a rebuff in the UN Security Council, particularly after Bush had been persuaded to go for and win the first vote in the Security Council. And the French claim that they had told us, don't come back to us for a second thing, just take your vote on the first vote and do it. We don't like it, but we'll live with it. Don't ask us to endorse it. But we did ask him to endorse it. The US perhaps could have done more internationally. Perhaps, but Colin Powell did try, and he could not win around enough small countries on the Security Council. So not only could we not get the French and the Germans and the Russians, we couldn't even get the small countries. We already had all the authority we needed from past UN resolutions, so the loss of moral authority before the war had started in defying the majority of the Security Council was extremely damaging and ought to have been anticipated. One has to go back to Suez for a parallel of putting your troops in on the ground with a seriously divided public opinion. Public opinion rallied when we put our troops in, as it usually does. The problems we face now in Iraq, I do think, are resolvable. The Iraqi police and army are being rebuilt, and they should start to improve the security situation with the US and UK military acting against Saddam Hussein's guerrilla tactics. Too slowly, the restoration of services is taking place, and Iraqi oil production will pick up without disruption, I think, provided an international oil consortium is created rather than the US attempting to take all the oil for their own companies. I imagine we're trying to influence that at the moment. The UK has, however, sustained a very serious diplomatic and political rebuff. There are deep political questions as to why our diplomacy failed so miserably. truly worrying questions as to why our intelligence appears to be so deficient, and with Al-Qaeda still active, we urgently need an authoritative, independent review on both sides of the Atlantic about the appropriateness of present techniques and methods for gaining intelligence and making assessments. On the present evidence, no one can credibly argue that the new number 10 secretariats and the Prime Minister have delivered. They have failed not because they are not ably led and staffed, but because their very existence only feeds the Prime Minister's illusion that all these complex European and Iraq-related issues, and in this case coinciding, can be handled by himself flying around for much publicised talks on Christian name terms with heads of government that have not been prepared to go along with his views. The brighter the people involved in the secretariat, the longer the illusion is likely to be maintained that this degree of centralised decision-making can succeed. Now, I've spoken out on this perhaps because I've reached the grand old age of 65 and that I wish the return of the ancien régime of cabinet government, that unfashionable subject, to put before you. But I want it in the national interest, and I think it is time we had a debate about this question. And these changes introduced by a massive majority need to be questioned. And we need to question it on the basis of its record. Now, some will say 2 years is too early to judge. These have been two very big mistakes, and I don't think we should wait for a third. At the very least, New Labour needs a functioning inner cabinet force. This means Gordon Brown, not just Tony Blair, consciously transferring power back to cabinet ministers and letting other Whitehall departments play a full part in contributing to collective decision making. The Prime Minister may fear that if he was to do this, it would lead to the return of old Labour attitudes and even policies, and that his modernisation project would wither on the vine. For that fear to be valid, it could only mean that he does not trust his present cabinet, in which case it's all the more important that he uses his power, and the legitimate power, to change ministers and fashion a structure that he can trust to make sensible decisions. I think actually they would make sensible decisions if they were given the opportunity. The one justification for the present structure, incidentally, which is not acceptable, is that it allowed us to go to war in Iraq. Democracy has to establish consent, and international diplomacy more than any other aspect of politics, and certainly in domestic politics, is best conducted with consent. It is not just a matter, therefore, of the Prime Minister foregoing spin or changing his style. Having recognised, as he did in his speech to the party conference on domestic policy, that the previous top-down approach will not work, it's important that he recognises that it does not work for foreign and defence policy either. The substance of needs redesigning and reinforcing by drawing on a wider pool of talent within departments and learning from experienced expert opinion. We do not yet have the much trumpeted joined-up government. We totally lack an energy policy. A coherent transport policy still eludes the government. I admit that the success of our Yes to Europe, No to the Euro campaign has been due in part to the government's incoherence. I can admit that, since the Euro is now a very distant prospect. But the country would gain from the economic choices being more widely discussed between departments and in cabinet. This government has the ability to negotiate a much better constitutional treaty than is currently on the table, on which, in my view, they could win a referendum. They can, with the US, recover the support of the Iraqi people on the ground in Iraq. They can, with UN legitimization, steer Iraq towards a democratic federal government. Unfettered by Euro membership, they can improve our industrial competitiveness and use the much higher growth rate in the UK economy compared to the average EU growth rate to invest in education, the NHS and transport. What should be even more important to Tony Blair is that if he made such changes, they would ensure that his legacy will be one of leaving behind a properly functioning machinery for cabinet collective decision making, capable of carrying the full-hearted consent of the British people for its policies. To achieve such European and international objectives, to continue that modernisation project, which in my view is still much needed, and to actually deliver results with improved public services, one change is vital. The duopoly of personal power that dominates Whitehall must be changed. Hitherto, Tony Blair must have feared reducing Gordon Brown's power from the Treasury in case he'd walked out of the Cabinet, and in the process seriously damaged the government. If Tony Blair demonstrates to the Cabinet that he's ready to wind down his new international secretariats in number 10 and share more power on international affairs with the Cabinet, he will put himself in an impregnable position in demanding that Gordon Brown must accept doing the same and wind down his total treasury control and bring to cabinet important aspects of financial and economic decision making. The personal fiefdoms of these two very able politicians, unanswerable to the cabinet, may have helped the inexperienced New Labour government establish itself. But now there are other serious players in the cabinet. It Today, these fiefdoms have become a looming threat to the government's competence, coherence, and credibility at home and abroad.
Lord Owen has agreed to take some questions. He's also said these questions will be on the record. We do have some mics in the both upstairs and downstairs, so can I ask you, after I've recognized you, to wait for the mic to reach you to be able to answer the question, ask your question. Christopher Hill.
Thank you, Professor Light, and thank you, Lord Owen, for what I think was a riveting lecture, and indeed an important one. I hope that your remarks do manage to stimulate the serious debate which we badly need on the foreign policy process and indeed on the European policy-making process, whatever our differing views on the substance of the issues at stake. I have two brief questions. One is what your view is on why prime ministers like Margaret Thatcher and Tony Blair have been able to get away with it. Why is it that Blair has been able to reduce cabinet meetings, as we hear, to 45 minutes? Is it just supine ministers, as Robin Cook suggests? Is it that the cabinet secretary is not doing his job in trying to make sure that proper procedure is followed? Or is it the power of appointment that the prime minister has in making sure that he's got his people in the key offices? The second question is more general, about the background to all this. I mean, clearly the last 50 or indeed 150 years have been about the gradual relative decline of the UK's position as a power in the world. And yet we're talking here about the growing dominance of number 10. Is there some connection with these, between these two phenomena? In other words, have prime ministers felt the need to react to the perception of British decline, talk up the importance of Britain's role in the world, partly in order to bolster their own position within the British system and indeed on the European network?
Well, why is Cabinet supine and Parliament supine? You know, those of us who were in opposition at the time argued all this about the Thatcher government, and we thought they're all a load of patsies, none of them are going to do anything. As for Geoffrey Howe, you know, being savaged like a dead sheep, said David Seeley. And then suddenly he did do something and surprised all of us. And this is the strange thing about the British parliamentary system. This has happened before. It sleeps. It seems to be just a sort of spaniel. And then suddenly it does seem to have bite. And I think myself, you're beginning to see that happening now. And I think it's not so easy. And of course, if they start to lose ground in public opinion, Prime Minister is no longer as popular. And then it spreads to the parliamentary party because they're worried about their seats. So, I mean, one reason I speak out is I'm not against this government. I actually want to see it succeed. And I think it has been, broadly speaking, a successful government. But I see the situation as being, if I'm in an optimistic mood, I say Blair's in a 1986 position in relation to Thatcher. And if I'm in a pessimistic mood, I cut myself in the shaving mirror, I say it's 1988. It's either 86 or 88. And he is young enough to learn the warning signs, and he ought to be able to adjust. Now, the problem is the Brown problem, and that's why I bring it in at the end. That is both the way to solve the problem. It's also, if you don't solve the Brown problem, you're not going to solve the Blair problem. Now, neither man wants the problem solved. They're very happy, in a way, in this duopoly. Now, then you come to the question about this thing of the role of governments. I was going to, one time when I looked at making a speech, I thought, well, I'm going to make a speech about how much weaker we really are, although we appear to be much stronger than when I was Foreign Secretary. And then I thought, well, they'll just say this is old, arrogant David Owen. So I decided not to do that. But I mean, at that stage, I looked at the size of the Royal Navy and the armed forces when I was Foreign Secretary compared to what it's now. I looked at some of the basic parameters. And many people simply forget how hard and how dangerous a world it was when the Cold War was on. I mean, it didn't make much headlines, but Berlin became, in my period, for a short time, again, a serious issue. Not anywhere near as bad as in 61 or before. But It was a much harder world in a way. Yet quite a lot of people think we have much more power and influence in the world. So this strategy of talking it all up and making it sound great has convinced a lot of people that we are actually more powerful. Now, one reason for that is a thoroughly good one, which is that our economy is no longer such a bad shape. And this is a big change. And whereas we limped through with much more real power in the 50s, 60s, and 70s, it was against the background of relative economic decline. And we have changed, for which I believe Thatcher deserves a great deal of credit, and I think that Blair deserves some credit too. I think he's followed through the changes that she did, and there have been some mistakes, but independence of the Bank of England was certainly the best decision that came out of this government. It was, of course, made in the first few days. But that's my answer to your question. I actually do think we are weaker, but I don't like saying it too much to people because they don't really believe it.
Question in the middle here. The gentleman with the glasses.
Philip Souter from the Young Federal Union. In regard to the British public opinion and the euro and the constitution, would you see it as a viable option to have a joint referendum on the euro and the constitution to bring to a head the sort of constant vacillation of the British public qua the euro and the constitution, and to bring out all of the real arguments and to dispel the ignorance that currently dominates these issues in the UK?
Well, I'm sure if the Prime Minister thinks that would give him the result he wants, he'll have one. I think there are some serious arguments which the Electoral Commission would argue that against it, in that you're confusing two quite separate questions. Of course, you're bringing it forward deliberately to confuse two separate questions. But I have no doubt that if they wish to do it, they would do it. I think if they did it, they would make it certain to lose both. But I think that, and I don't necessarily want, I don't want to lose the treaty. I'd much prefer that we do get agreement in the treaty. I want these negotiations to succeed. So personally, I would certainly vote against the euro. Not permanently. I can imagine circumstances, get their act together. But you haven't got a prayer of winning a euro referendum. Believe me, this issue is completely off the agenda. This is Peter Mandelson and you talking about this. There isn't anybody out there who thinks this is a remote possibility. It's absolutely dead. It'll have to have an improvement in the eurozone economies. They'll have to get their act together on the stability pact. They'll have to make changes in the way the ECB is performing before you can possibly consider winning a referendum on the euro. So the Prime Minister's not stupid. I don't think he'll deliberately bring two things together. Well, you're not going to get a referendum. It'll only come if the House of Lords was to reject it decisively and continuously. And even then, I doubt you'd get it. I think he'd prefer to have a general election first.
Question in the third row.
I believe you should have one.
Thank you, Professor Margaret. I'm sorry, Margaret Light. Yep. Mr. Owen, puppet, I mean, not merely puppet, lobotomized puppet. That is how Guardian portrayed your foreign office machinery. So do you think that what sort of influence the number 10 or Gordon Brown's number 10 or British government has got in the formulation of the common European foreign policy? At least, are you in a position to at least to lead the Commonwealth? In a nutshell, I just wanted to know this delusional shoulder-to-shoulder friendship. Is it a remediable one?
Who is a puppet?
Lobotomized puppet. That is how your own Guardian portrayed your foreign office machinery, because they think that you don't have a foreign policy at all.
In my time, in
1970s? No. This is the modern time, third century. They think that everybody is common. I'm an Indian, has got a cop. I want to come and argue in the Security Council to stop you warmongers waging war against any poor countries.
I've been a long-standing supporter of India being on the Security Council. I think it's absurd that the largest democracy in the world is not on the Security Council. And I think it's pretty hard to go on believing that the Federal Republic of Germany and Japan should pay such large contributions and not be on. And I think there's a pretty healthy case for saying that Brazil is by far the largest Latin American country should be on. I don't think South Africa.
You looked at South Africa, that is what South Africa needs. Who will represent Africa?
I don't think you can just make it because for a temporary period we're all in favor of South Africa. South Africa's, in comparison to Nigeria, is a very much smaller African country. And yes, but there should be an African country anyhow. We can agree with that. Those are other changes. I think that as far as the Commonwealth is concerned, the Commonwealth will be taken seriously if it takes itself seriously. And it takes itself seriously if, when it appoints a committee to look into what's happening in Zimbabwe, it sticks to its position and doesn't equivocate and vacillate. and it took the Australian Prime Minister to be absolutely firm and resolute, with, incidentally, previous Conservative Prime Ministers with a long, proud record of helping Zimbabwe after independence with a substantial aid budget. So Australia has not come just Johnny-come-lately to the African issue. They've actually been there for the last 20 years, quite seriously, as Canada's been for the last 50 years. And I don't think you should underestimate the Commonwealth, nor overestimate its strength. Its strength is from consensus. Its strength is its wish to do something. And when it came, as I say, in under Lord Carrington's Lancaster House, the Commonwealth military, mainly British, but it was with other contributions from other countries, supervised the election, they did it very well. And I think there is a role for Commonwealth. So if the Guardian said that, I think it's one of its sweeping generalizations, which from time to time, even such a reputable paper as that occasionally makes.
There's a question at the back there. Yeah.
Lord Owen, in response to your proposition that the EU Constitution should be put to referenda first before the government can sign it, would you not see that perhaps this is too sensitive of an issue to leave to people who are perhaps ignorant to how the EU operates? Especially in this country where I know most people don't even know whom their MEP is.
Well, this is the old argument about democracy. Can you trust the people? And it is a tricky issue. And I'm not a believer in a plebiscitary democracy on the scale of Switzerland, but I think that we are moving to a much more educated population. I think they do know more, in some respects, of what's going on. I won't say that's necessary for everybody in the population, but I think it's a bigger section of educated, interested people. Also, when posed with the question, it's extraordinary how, in my view, the British public get it right. I mean, I've been thrown out of government twice, and each time I think I deserve to be thrown out of government. And I actually almost did think that during the election. And, you know, they come to it from a different judgment. I did try to persuade Roy Jenkins, when I was very close to him in those days, in 72, to accept a referendum then. He argued against it powerfully, and I resigned with him because I believed in staying together. But I was very pleased with the 75 referendum, and had we not had the 75 referendum, the Labour Party would not have come back as quickly as it did in 87 to Europe, and their absence from and their commitment to come out of the European community, which they entered into in 1980, which lasted 7 years. If there hadn't been a referendum, it might have lasted 12 years. And I think that, you know, the legitimization of entry by that referendum was a necessary process. So I don't think every IGC treaty should go automatically. And 3 years ago, I moved an amendment in the House of Lords, supported by Jim Pryor, supported by Robert Skidelsky and Dennis Healy, which tried to define a constitutional issue of sufficient importance that that would have an automatic referendum. The snag was, who was going to decide? And we just thought that the Speaker of the House of Commons could decide, but that it ran into problems at the time. But I still think that's what you need. You don't want a referendum on every issue, but on big issues of constitutional importance, I think you do need one. And particularly now as the EU gets closer to integration, these steps become very much more important to every people. And then if the decision comes that we do want to go into a fully integrated European community and eventually with its president and cabinet, I'd accept it. I'm a Democrat. Maybe your generation want that. If you want it, that's fine. Take for me. But as I say, it may be just my old age and arthritic knee.
A question upstairs at the back.
Gregory Hall from Radio Free Asia. Lord Owen, Tony Blair now is under tremendous pressure. His popularity is historically low. And do you think the Labour Party can survive the next term? Or if there is any person can do better than Tony Blair, could you name any person who can can build up a stronger as the same thing? At least in the Foreign Affairs Act, he's more capable than Tony Blair.
No, look, I'm out of politics. I'm not any longer. I've been in politics quite a long time. I opted out when my party disappeared. So I was in at the death, so to speak, and then I decided to go to the House of Lords. But I'm a crossbencher, and I don't get very much bought. And there are people who think that this speech, one of the criticisms I've had from somebody who's close to me, says it's too political, I shouldn't speak like this. And I did turn it down a bit. But so I'm entitled every now and then to do it. But you take me down a path which I'm not wildly keen to go. But since I've made some criticisms of Tony Blair, I'm very happy to say that he's been an extremely good Prime Minister. I welcome New Labour. I'm afraid I do find a hell of a lot of the SDP policy in New Labour's policy, and I have no difficulty in following it. That doesn't mean that I accept everything he's done or anything. If you ask me, is there a better person, I can't see it on the horizon, but that's not for me to choose. It's the parliamentary party that chooses, plus the trade union bloc vote, which I've totally opposed as being part of the mechanism for choosing. But that's their choice. But I'm not advocating a change of Blair. I believe in his own good and in the country's good. He should change, just as he's decided that he's got to give up spin and all that. Thank goodness. Let's hope he really isn't about to do it. And that isn't a spin. I think he should change the structure of government. Now he wants to have a great big consultation with the public about domestic policy, and we're promised the biggest consultation. Well, why the hell are you refusing to have a referendum on the Constitution? And why aren't you looking pretty seriously at the structures you've yourself created for its record in conduct of foreign policy? Now, these are the issues. I think he is capable of learning and changing in office. If he's not, if he's totally rigid, then I think he'll go the way of Thatcher.
Another question upstairs.
While looking at the title of the speech, there's rather a reference to an institution, which is Downing Street number 10, than the leaders, whereas you kept underlining the names of leaders such as Blair and Thatcher. So is it rather individuals than the institutions whose dominance is growing? And we have got some examples of that on the world politics as well, from Cheney, Rumsfeld, maybe Arnold the Terminator next. And then what is the role of the foreign policy bureaucracy in the defense establishment, particularly the military wing, the military itself, in leaders gaining such dominance? And the second question is, you said you support the war in Iraq. One of the mottos of this government, and especially New Labour when it came to power, has been ethical foreign policy. I would be interested in hearing what link you would establish between going to war in Iraq and ethical foreign policy promoted by New Labour.
Well, firstly, an ethical foreign policy is not new. It is traditional for parties of the left, of centre. I was fortunate to have President Jimmy Carter actively pursuing a policy of human rights. It made it much easier for me to do so when I was Foreign Secretary. I actually wrote a book on human rights when I was Foreign Secretary. So there is a slight tendency for New Labour to think that everything is new. They have actually happened before. It helps me to argue a little bit the other point. It's fashionable to decry Harold Wilson, but just remember, you know, he was at one time Prime Minister with a very large majority. That was my first Parliament from 66 to 70. Now, he came unstuck economically, and that may be an argument why he didn't do some of these centralization of powers. But when he was all-powerful, he didn't do it, and he didn't believe in it. He did actually believe in cabinet government, and he did believe in the departments. Now, some would say, oh, that was because he was a civil servant during the war, and he was slightly bureaucratic, and he was a Boy Scout, and a variety of different things like that. But, I mean, those aren't epithets that are not exclusively applied to Harold Wilson. He deliberately chose, with a large Labour majority, not to use it. But more important, actually, the massive majority. He did not in any way subvert the parliamentary process. Far from it. Went over there backwards. Herbert Morrison as leader of the House and others, they did not force through. You know, there was that unfortunate speech by Hartley Shawcross, we are the masters now, but that was not the basic attitude of that cabinet. They put through the most radical, dramatic changes, far more radical than anything we've seen from the Blair government, and they did it through due process, and they worked with the committees, and they worked with the structures, and there was no question of political advisers. Attlee would no more have given Jonathan Powell or Alastair Campbell the power to order civil servants around than pass out. Now, these are big changes that have been come through, and they've been acquiesced in. And with frankness, I'm glad to be speaking to the LSE, because I presume, in the traditional tendency, that there is the odd Labour supporter here. Now, it's much better that this criticism should come not from the traitor Owen, but from serious Labour people. And they should do it. And I think there has been an absolutely appalling absence of academic examination of governmental trends and decision-making processes.
It is the absolute bedrock of democracy. These blighters will always take more power if you let them. I would have done so at the same time. I'm not saying I'm a great paragon of virtue. You give a politician, a cabinet minister, a chance of making decisions without going to the tedious business of legislation. That's why a lot of them like the EU, because they don't have to go through legislation. They just go to the council meeting, becomes a legislative chamber, and it's through. And you can come back and say, I only did it because X, Y, and Z country wanted, or I was voted down, or I would have been voted down if I voted. In many ways, it's easier for them. Now, we have to try to deal with that issue in the European Union. I happen to remain, as I have always been, a solid supporter of the European Union. I rather smile when I'm told great lectures about how I'm a Eurosceptic or something from people who spent the whole of the 80s trying to take us out.
I'm going to take the last question from the gentleman back there.
Yeah, and 2 months ago, Margot Heseltine wrote an article in The Guardian where he said that last November he had been to some meeting, select meeting, which addressed by a senior official close to the Bush administration, I think that's what he said, unnamed, and where the senior official said last November that there was definitely that there was going to be a war, no matter what the UN weapons inspectors were just about to enter into Iraq, no matter what the UN resolutions, what the UN resolutions are. So I'm saying all this whole debate, you know, did last November's UN resolution give a justification for war, or yes or no? I mean, basically, it's all. I'm afraid to say it's that debate is sometimes a matter for international lawyers to argue over for the next decades to come. But the point is, you know, this is Margot Heseltine said was told quite clearly that there was going to be a war. So was saying in terms of I'm referring to your. What you're discussing, your discussions about the second UN resolution, blah, blah, etc. From what Michael Heseltine wrote in The Guardian 2 months ago, it's all rather academic.
Well, to be frank, I think what I was saying supported that view. The Bush went to Congress, both houses, before the midterm elections and asked for support to go to war. And at that stage, he was using the word topple Saddam Hussein quite frequently. Now, they don't care about the UN Charter. You don't get votes in the United States by keeping the UN Charter. Tony Blair's problem is that his party does respect the UN Charter, and that is actually conservative and liberals as well. And I strongly support it. And therefore, I've always, even in the most difficult times, wanted to work within the UN Charter. And I specifically took up on this issue. I think it was silly to go on weapons of mass destruction. I think it would have been better to have gone on the ceasefire thing. And people understand that better. If I could just answer this question, I was rung up by my dear mother, who's now died, in the middle of the 91 Iraq War, which didn't last very long. And you remember, there was a sort of turkey shoot, it was called, on the road to Basra. And she says, David, you've got to ring up President Bush and tell him to stop. And I said, Mother, these days, I have no power. I'm totally incapable. She says, you've got to tell him to stop. So I put on the news. 5 minutes later, Colin Powell announced that they'd stopped. My mother, to the dying day, thought that I had stopped it. And I wasn't going to change her mind about that. But the basic thing about it is that the Americans do take these seriously. They got authorization and they were going to go to war. And Thatcher and Major did exactly the same in the 91 war. Now this time, there was too much footling around about whether you are. You can't footle around. If you put your troops in, you're going to go to war unless there's a dramatic change. Now, the American Secretary of State Baker says, when he flew into Baghdad, if Saddam Hussein had said, I will now withdraw my troops, they would not have been able to go to war. But he hoped and prayed he wouldn't, because he knew he wanted to be defeated. Now, the problem is, it's a democratic problem. You have to go right to the point of war. And yet, in fairness, you've always got to hold out that you could say stop. The problem of this government was they didn't go to the full extent of going to Parliament early, telling them that thing. They were all the time playing around with it. And I think that that's what caused indecision. And one of the reasons was he wasn't taking the cabinet into his confidence. He didn't go to them and say, now look here, I've got these soldiers that are going to be out there. There's a period where it gets too bloody hot to fight. There's a very small period in which I can do it. I'm doing this with the Americans. We've got to be disciplined about this. Then the likelihood is there going to be war. You don't actually spend your time saying, fingers crossed to Robin Cook, at that stage you should be open and blunt with him. We're likely to go to war, Robin, and you know bloody well we're likely to go to war, and you were in this decision-making process in 1998 when we took a much more retaliatory action against them. Have no more of this hogwash. And I think that this is again goes to the fundamentals of the way this war was approached. The decision-making was highly personalised inside Number 10. Now, that is not the way to go to war. That is not the way to carry, first of all, your cabinet colleagues with you. There was a war cabinet, but it was not a serious body. And that is our problem. You know, and with I know somebody who was very senior in the development world, came over to Britain, went to see the Chancellor of the Exchequer in February, I think it was. I mean, the war was, you know, there was no discussion about post-war reconstruction. Now, they were not focused on the issue. Now, you can't expect to have a successful thing. After all the reason why we didn't go and take Baghdad in 91 was we knew that there were dangers of going in and taking over Iraq. We knew the fragmentation problem. It's all been known. This time we were going to do it. Therefore, the aftermath, and it was pretty clear it was going to be a fairly simple military job, but there was not that degree of serious think tanks. Foreign secretaries didn't clearly go through with their officials hour after hour, what's going to happen if this happens, what's going to happen if that, what's going to be the effect of Iran, what's going to be the implication of the Kurds, what's going to be the relationship of the Ba'athist party, should we dismantle the army? These are, you know, the sort of things you have to discuss. I don't believe they were ever discussed in a serious way.
Ladies and gentlemen, I apologize to those whose questions I cannot take. I'm sure you would like to join me in saying that if the rest of the former foreign ministers are half as frank and even a quarter as funny, then we're going to have a wonderful series. I can't think of a better way to have started the series, and I'd like to thank you very much on all our behalves for coming and talking to us.